Well, have you ever heard of a skinwalker? According to the myths of Native Americans, the skinwalkers are evil medicine men, or even the enchanted corpses of medicine men. Either way, they're supposed to be possessed by a demon. They have pale white skin, and according to some, a preference for human flesh. But whatever happened on a remote ranch in Utah? In a moment, Hunt for the Skinwalker with Colm Kelleher and George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. George Knapp is an 8-time Emmy Award-winning journalist whose reporting on Nevada's infamous Area 51 military base was selected by UPI as the best individual achievement by a reporter in 1989. Other awards include the Associated Press's Mark Twain Award for News Writing and the very prestigious Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting. George is an anchor and reporter for the CBS affiliate KLIS-TV in Las Vegas, and also writes a weekly column for a Las Vegas newspaper. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. George, welcome to the program. We're going to keep you up for a long time tonight.
That's what I'm here for, George. Thanks for having us.
And by the way, I just want you to know I have been a fan of yours for a number of years, and it's an honor to have you on Coast to Coast with us tonight.
Well, I'm really pleased that you asked us, and the feeling is mutual. I'm a fan of yours as well. This is the place to get this kind of information.
Colm Kelleher, Ph.D., is a research scientist. He's an author currently in the biotechnology sector. Dr. Kelleher is a biochemist with a 20-year research career in cell and molecular biology, following his Ph.D. in biochemistry from the University of Dublin, Trinity College, 1983. Dr. Kelleher worked at the Ontario Cancer Institute, the Terry Fox Cancer Research Laboratory, and the National Jewish Center for Immunology and Respiratory Medicine. Before moving to the biotechnology sector and as a senior research scientist, he worked as a project manager and team leader at a private research institute from 1996 to 2004, using forensic science to unravel scientific anomalies. He is back on Coast to Coast. Colm, good to have you.
Great to be here again, George. It's been a while.
What an incredible story that you two were part of, witnesses of. Let's start, first of all, Colm, if you can just tell me just a little bit of your relationship with George Knapp, how that started, and then we'll get into this. And, George, before you're off with us tonight on this three-hour extravaganza, we're going to have to talk with you about Area 51 as well, okay?
I kind of thought that might be coming.
What a newsman. What an instinct you have for news. Colm, how did the relationship start with you and George?
Well, George has actually had a relationship with Robert Bigelow, who is the CEO of the National Institute for Discovery Science, going all the way back into the 1990s and even earlier, I believe. So when Robert Bigelow formed the National Institute for Discovery Science in 1995, George was already part of the brainstorming process. So over the years, as NIDS became more and more of a scientific organization, when staff scientists were hired, when the Science Advisory Board was put together, George was a constant sounding board throughout that whole process. So he was kind of a fly on the wall, so to speak, over many, many years with respect to the formation of NIDS and the projects that were going on with NIDS. So he I think of any journalist has had a bird's eye view of the whole process.
And is that relationship then, is that how you and George developed a working relationship?
That's correct. Towards the end of the stint at NIDS, George was probably the only journalist that was really allowed on the property up in the northeastern Utah that we're going to be discussing. And he spent quite a while up there. So gradually, as the research came to fruition, so to speak, George in 2002 issued a couple of articles written in a Las Vegas newspaper that essentially put the whole Utah ranch on the map globally. There was a tremendous amount of interest in those two articles that they were the first documentation of some of the activity that had happened on the Utah ranch. And that was really the beginning of this whole lengthy process where we began to collaborate on a book.
George, as you know, working in the mainstream media, I've been there before. It's very difficult to get news directors and other executives interested in the unusual, the mysteries, the paranormal. You've made a career out of this in Las Vegas especially. How did you get interested in this field? How did a newsman with a great guts for news then begin to realize there's a little bit more out there on this planet?
It started with the Area 51 stuff, which we'll talk about later. I had the same kind of general curiosity about UFOs that probably everyone has, but had never really done any serious work until a guy named John Lear came into the station. And John Lear, people have different opinions about him, but he had a certain amount of credibility with KLAS-TV, where I work, because he'd been instrumental in helping us to break the story of the stealth fighter, which was being tested out at Area 51. It was a national story, and John was very helpful in helping us to break it. And because of that, he would come into the station with other story ideas, and one of them was about UFOs and what was going on at Area 51. He came in with a pile of documents one day trying to interest my mentor, the late Ned Day, into pursuing this matter. Ned would have no part of it because of the kind of stigma that you're referring to,
yep.
George. And but I was eavesdropping, as usual, and I said, hey, let me take a look at that stuff. And I thought it was kind of interesting. I put John Lear on a program that I produced, a little public affairs program that is aired in the middle of the night and that nobody watches. And suddenly the phone is ringing off the hook and people are expressing interest in it. I had Lear on again, and the response was bigger. I had him on a third time, and which is when he started talking about the rumors about Area 51. And the response was even bigger. And I realized, hey, this is really something that touches the pulse of the public. It has not been given a fair shake by journalism, certainly, and by science. And so I started taking a look at it and looking into the material, and I realized, you know, 90% of the sightings can be explained. 95% of all the conspiracy theories are probably nonsense. But at the core, there is an unexplained essence that that deserves some serious scrutiny, because this could be the biggest story of all time. So that's how I got started.
Had you not been in the market that you are in, would your path, your career path, have taken a different twist?
Probably. I mean, the trust that KLAS gave me then and still gives me now is probably unique. You don't see a lot of people in my profession who do more than a passing story here or there, a feature, a kind of a yuck kind of a put down of the topic. And the fact that they gave me the freedom to pursue the Area 51 stuff and UFOs in general really is a unique development.
And I want everyone to know that George Knapp is known throughout the UFO community, throughout the investigative community, for his work, because there aren't a lot of hard news, mainstream newscasters who go out there and do this kind of investigating. Of course, Linda Moulton Howe used to do some of that when she was in Boston as a producer. But George Knapp is doing this now as a career at the television station he's at, the CBS affiliate in Las Vegas, KLAS. And he's doing just yeoman's work, breaking stories all around the country. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've tapped into some of his work to use as stories during my days in St. Louis. I mean, it is mind-blowing. You don't win 8 Emmys by being lucky. You don't win an Edward R. Murrow Award for investigative training in work by being lucky. He's done a thorough job. This is going to be a fascinating program tonight. Colm and George, regardless of who I address any questions to tonight on this incredible story, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, both of you jump in at any time. Consider this just a discussion, as opposed to an interview. This area in northeastern Utah has a reputation for strange phenomena. Tell me, either one of you jump in on this one, tell me about this region. What are we talking about here?
Colm, why don't you start?
Well, it's a region that is about 150 miles south or east of Salt Lake City. It's off the beaten track, so It is pretty isolated. It is obviously dominated by the Mormon community, but it also has a fairly big Native American presence in the case of the Utes, and it lies between Vernal and Roosevelt. They're basically the towns that are involved. So the ranch is in the middle of the Uinta Basin, which has had at least a 50-year history, almost continuous history of bizarre activity. And that was documented beginning in 1951 by a chap called Junior Hicks, who happened to be the local science teacher. So he he and a bunch of his students in 1951 had a dramatic sighting of this large object during the daylight when half the school was looking up at this object going across the school. And this kind of convinced him that something unusual was in the sky. So he became the unofficial source of a lot of these a lot of the reports throughout the basin.
Junior Hicks actually developed a catalog of more than 400 pretty interesting cases, and he got so many of the cases because the UFO sightings were so frequent in the area that he mostly concentrated on the most dramatic ones, close encounter type incidents where beings were seen and saucers landed, things of that sort. And he's a pretty thorough investigator, and because he lived in the area, people trusted him, and he didn't reveal their identities or make fun of them, so he got more and more information over the years. He was a very valuable resource for us, but what it indicated to us is his catalog was that this has been going on a long time. He even found records that indicate that the area had the first white settlers in the area, the Spanish explorers who went through there in the 1770s, had their own UFO experiences, what we'd call UFO experiences. So it's been going on a long time. And then, of course, he also collected the lore from the Ute tribe that had been there, and they had indicated that the stories go back many, many generations.
This picture on your book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, it looks like a small ranch. The house is very modest.
Oh, it is. It's one of the typical homesteads that flourished in that area in the 1920s, 1930s. And it is right in the middle of this Ute reservation. It's kind of interesting. It's bounded on a couple of sides by the Ute reservation. But it is a very small homestead, and the ranch is a 480-acre property. The homestead lies just pretty well at the eastern edge of the property, but even during the 1920s and 1930s, there were other homesteads on that property, too, which have since been abandoned. But this is not a luxury living kind of a situation. It is pretty remote, and it's pretty basic.
And we should point out that for all the lore about the Uinta Basin that goes back so many years, the central focus of the activity has always been this particular ranch. That is where the title for the book comes from. The Ute tribe refers to this 480-acre property as the Path of the Skinwalker. They sort of use it as a blanket explanation to compensate for all of the strange activity that they have witnessed on that property for so many generations.
Do you think anything has happened on this property in years gone past that was probably one of the reasons why there's been so much unusual activity in this area?
That's very, very difficult to say. The NIDS organization actually did interview a few people who worked on the property in the 1970s. And we actually also interviewed the previous owners to the Gorman family who occupied the property from 1994 through 1996. The previous owners were a family from Salt Lake City, and they owned the property stretching back at least 20 years. But prior to that, it gets pretty misty. We actually looked in the local Mormon records in Vernal for property transfers, and we went to the local property office too. It gets pretty misty beyond the 1960s going back. But you know, one could speculate that a lot of the strange phenomena may be tied geographically to that spot rather than be associated with the people. And the evidence that we have from the interviews of people who have occupied the ranch before that seems to indicate that it may be tied to the geography rather than the occupants of the ranch.
And Colum, how often were you out in this region? How much time did you spend there?
Well, once the family had basically decided to sell the property to the National Institute for Discovery Science, that happened in August of 1996. We essentially were living on the property pretty well all the time through 1996. We stopped for a while in the winter of 1996, began early in 1997, went all the way through 1997. There were occasions, a few days here and there, when we weren't on the property, but then the ranch manager would call us and we would get back on the property. Then through 1998, strong presence on the property. After that, we had a couple of investigators who would go there between the end of 1998 all the way through 2002. So there was almost a continuous presence of researchers on the property beginning in August of 1996.
And George, how about you as an investigative reporter? Would you periodically pop down to the property?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get there until most of the most dramatic events had already occurred. I was begging to go, but that just wasn't in the cards. I've only made five visits to the property, but I had access to all of the reports as they were pouring in through NIDS, and Colin would share information with me as well as Bob Bigelow. So I knew what was going on, was privy to it, and it drove me absolutely crazy that I was not allowed to be there for a while. But you have to understand, George, that they didn't want to attract a lot of attention to the property.
Right.
The interactive nature of the phenomena made it essential that you didn't have a lot of interlopers or people parking in RVs and having tailgate parties and things of that sort, because it would interfere with the research, and you didn't know what the results would be.
Could either one of you feel strange vibes from the area when you were there, Colm, George?
There was really, during the hundreds of days that I was on the property, there was really only once or twice when I felt that there was anything remotely bizarre. And that was one occasion in particular, and this was probably in 1997, actually, early summer of 1997, when myself and this other investigator were walking slowly through this thick undergrowth brush on the property. We were tracking these unusual footprints that we had found. We had just gone through the process of documenting them. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I had this distinct feeling of being watched. And it was a pretty unique feeling. It was like something was very, very close to me.
I'll tell you that
I had a very strong smell, like a strong odor, very heavy sulfur. I glanced to the investigator who was just like a couple of hundred feet away. He had obviously felt or sensed something also. So later on, we didn't actually communicate at that time. I looked around and continued the tracking process. But we debriefed later on, and we found that at that precise time, both of us had this distinct feeling of being watched. Something was very close to us. We couldn't see it. It was broad daylight. That was really the only time that I felt physically threatened, so to speak, on the property.
How about you, George?
I know my feeling was different. I basically anticipated a feeling of dread when I got on the property because I'd read some of the dramatic things that had happened, dangerous things, violent things. But the feeling I had was one of calm and peace, and it's a overwhelming sort of a feeling that I've had each time I've visited the place, and I've since talked to other people who have the same sort of a feeling of calm, that it's a good sort of a sense, as strange as that may sound.
When we come back, we're going to really get into this story. It's an incredible story, the hunt for the Skinwalker and some of the things that went on this property. Our guests tonight, Colm Kelleher and George Knapp. Colm's website, of course, huntfortheskinwalker.com or colmkelleher.com. Both of those websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and also for George Knapp, part of the huntfortheskinwalker.com website as well. Makes it very easy to get to when you go to the coasttocoastam.com website. We'll be back in a moment with both of them as we continue now this discussion of this truly remarkable story, including some incredible creatures that have been seen in that area as well. Vanishing and mutilated cattle, unidentified flying objects, and the appearance of some of these huge otherworldly creatures. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Colm Kelleher and George Knapp as we talk about this incredible story called The Hunt for the Skinwalker. Colm and George, your book talks about for more than 50 years there have been bizarre events at that remote Utah ranch. Is that because it's been documented? Is it possible that this could have been going on there for hundreds of years just on that bare land?
Oh, I think that's more than possible because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Junior Hicks was really the person that started getting things organized in terms of collating all of the information. everybody trusted this guy because he was a pillar of the community. Not only was he high up in the Mormon establishment, but he was also a high school teacher, you know, carries a certain amount of cachet.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually, beginning in 1951, he became the focus of all of the reports throughout the community. He established a reputation for never, spreading rumors about what people had told him and keeping people's confidences. So over a period of sort of a few decades, he accumulated between 400 and 500 cases, and they were specifically selected to eliminate all of the lights in the sky, the distant stuff that was happening to people. The 400 to 500 cases that he documented were all up close and personal. A lot of them were daylight sightings. A lot of them were really sort of multiple witness sightings, too. There was a book actually written in the 1970s by Frank Salisbury, who was a Utah plant biochemist. And he basically took Junior Hicks's data, put it into a book, and the book sold extremely well because it was written by a scientist. And throughout the 1970s and 80s, these incidents kept on happening up till the arrival of NIDS in 1996. Junior Hicks also worked as an electrical contractor throughout the Uinta Basin, so he was familiar with the ranch. And, you know, he had seen stuff on the property even before we arrived.
We're going to talk about the family that was the focus of the Skinwalker book in just a second. But when I introduced both of you, I talked a little bit about skinwalkers and what, at least a definition of some Native Americans, what they might be. And they all seem to agree that they're demonically possessed or some kind of evil surrounds these. Do you believe that's the case?
Well, I mean, the Native Americans sure do. They take it very seriously, and the evidence of that is the fact how hard it was for us to get any of them to talk to us about it. You research the lore. Anthropologists have addressed this in several academic treatises, and it's clear that the Navajo, the Utes, and the Hopi and other tribes all have their versions of skinwalkers, but it's basically the same thing, that this is an evil sorcerer, a witch, capable of shape-shifting, turning into animals, werewolves, that sort of thing. And nothing but bad things come from skinwalkers. So when the Ute tribe deemed this property that we're talking about as it being in the path of the skinwalker, they were basically admonishing their members not to go on the property, to stay away from it, because it was a place of evil.
I was going to say, they tried to ignore that region for as long as they could, couldn't they?
Yeah, exactly, and some of them have gone on it, but, you know, and we're not saying they're literally, we're taking skinwalkers at face value, that they're real, but the Navajo and the Utes certainly take them as real. And that has spilled over into the study that was done by NIDS.
Tell me about the family, the Gorman family. Who were they?
Well, they were a ranching family that had come in from out of state in late 1994. They really wanted to get away from the small town sort of gossiping, so they wanted to get a secluded property. And when they found this property in northeastern Utah, they were absolutely delighted. Tom Gorman was a rancher. He specialized in artificial insemination of high-end cattle,
mm-hmm.
mostly Black Angus and Simmentals. And he bred these animals. They were all registered animals. They were all very, very valuable in the thousands of dollars. So his ranching operation was very, very different from the standard operation that was in the Uinta Basin. And within a couple of years of him arriving there, he had established a reputation as somebody who could sell very, very high-end cattle. And, you know, people came from out of state, actually, to buy his animals. So this was not your normal sort of, ranching operation at all. It was specific. He did all of the artificial insemination himself, so he had quite a reputation. So if and when he lost an animal, which did happen very quickly after the family arrived on the property. It was a very, very big deal. Normal attrition for ranching operations, especially small ranches, are in the sort of 2 to 3%. If this guy lost one animal out of 100, it was a very big deal because of the economics of
his operation. Sure, this was a prized breeding stock for him, I'm sure.
Exactly, that was the case. So the family moved on to this property, which had been abandoned for about 7 years before they had moved on. And they moved on in late 1994. So it was shortly thereafter that things began to get very strange.
What kind of things happened to the Gorman family there?
Well, George, maybe you could relate the wolf story.
Well, on the first day that they were moving onto the property, as they are unloading their stuff, they noticed there was a large animal out on the edge of one of these pastures, and it was a wolf. And they sort of remarked to each other, "Hey, we didn't realize there were wolves in this area." And this thing was slowly sidling its way across the pasture toward them. And they surmised that, hey, this thing is not only a wolf, it's a huge wolf. I mean, larger than the size of a small horse, and it appeared to be tamed. Suddenly it comes walking into the midst of where the family is standing next to the corral and sidles up to them, and they assume it's tamed. They could smell that it had been raining. They could smell a wet dog sort of a smell. And this thing is walking among them, and it suddenly sees a calf that's in the corral next to them, and walks towards it and snaps its jaws on the snout of this calf and is trying to pull it through these bars. The rancher, of course, reacted quickly. He starts kicking the wolf. It makes no impact. He grabbed a baseball bat or an axe handle and starts whacking it on the back. It doesn't even flinch. It's paying no attention to him. He sends his son over to the truck to grab a .357 Magnum handgun, the most powerful handgun in the world, and shoots this thing. Doesn't budge, shoots it again, shoots it a third time. It was on the third shot that the wolf sort of lets go of the calf, but it's just standing there. It's not bleeding. It's not making any noise. It's showing no signs of distress whatsoever. They're stunned, quite frankly, stunned and frightened by it. They go into the house, grab a powerful .30-06 hunting rifle. The guy, this rancher Gorman, was a world-class hunter, and he tells the family basically stand back, takes a shot at this thing, blasts it, and again, no impact. He takes another shot, a fifth shot, should have brought down anything, any kind of animal, an elephant, an elk,
sure,
anything. A chunk of flesh flies off the wolf, and it just sort of, it still is not crying, nothing, showing no signs of distress. It sort of walks, slowly walks away and starts leaving, walking back across the pasture where it came from. Well, they realize something really unusual is happening here, so they grabbed another hunting rifle and go after it. They track it through this underbrush and into this wet area near a creek that borders the property. They're following the tracks through the brush and can see them very clearly in the mud. They get to a point, and the tracks just disappear.
Poof.
The animal disappeared into thin air. They go back and picked up the chunk of flesh that had flown off the wolf from the last shot, and it was flesh that looked like it had been out on the property, out in the sun for several days, rotten, decayed. Very, very strange. That's strange. Day one.
The family at that point, were they even contemplating getting out of there?
Well, I think the reaction was they were totally mystified by what had happened because they had no knowledge. The previous owners had not said anything to them about anything unusual on the property. So I think they were prepared to forget about that incident as quickly as possible. Now, the interesting thing was in the next couple of months, they had talked with some of their neighbors, and their neighbors had said, you know, there's a herd of really big wolves on your property. So they were at least sort of mollified because they knew that other people had seen these animals also. Within a few weeks, the wife was coming back from town. And she had stopped her gray Chevette at the gate of the property. It was just locking the gate, having opened it. And she noticed one of these animals right beside her car. And she figured that the animal was so big. This was not your ordinary sized wolf. This animal was so big that it was almost reaching the roof of the Chevette. She was terrified by the size of the thing. These animals were like twice, three times the size of a normal wolf, and
plus
they were unbelievably tame.
Yeah, including, as you said, George, bulletproof, almost robotic.
Yeah, they had some very unusual properties. Now, within a few weeks of that last incident with the Chevette at the ranch gate, those animals disappeared from the property and were never seen again. It was like they vanished off the face of the earth. They saw that the family saw them in the distance a few times, and then they were gone, never seen again.
Did other creatures replace them? Different kinds of creatures?
Well, throughout the you know, as the whole thing unfolded between 1994 and when NIDS arrived in August of 1996, September 96, there were a variety of unusual creatures seen. The Gormans saw very unusual birds on the property. There were some sightings of what might have been Sasquatch-like creatures in the distance. And then when the NIDS team arrived on the property in 1996.
Now, that's when the Gormans sold, right?
That's when they sold the property after a litany of very, very high strangeness.
Well, did they sell to get out, or did Bigelow and group make such a good offer they had to sell?
Well, it was they had reached the end of their tether. They had basically been subjected to a series of mind games happening almost on a daily basis for, you know, 18 to 20 months. I had talked about their high-end cattle. Over a period of that 20 months, they lost through either mutilation, death, or disappearance about 12 of their high-end animals out of a herd of 80, which was an unacceptable attrition rate. Financially, it was devastating. It was really a particular incident that happened in May, I believe, of 1996, in which Tom Gorman was watching his dogs on the property. He was sitting outside. He was relaxing. It was an evening when he noticed a blue orb, one of these circular orb objects that had become very, very common occurrences on the property. It was moving quickly close to the ground. The dogs saw it, and Gorman usually protected his animals when any of these objects were in the vicinity. But at this time, he lost his patience, and he set the dogs on this object. They began chasing this object, which was only a few feet off the ground, obviously being guided intelligently.
Basketball size?
It was just smaller than basketball size.
Right.
It was very, very blue. It actually cast a blue light on the ground as it maneuvered. But each time the dogs would lunge at it, it would just skip out of the way, obviously sort of taking evasive maneuvers. And slowly it was leading the dogs towards this dense copse of bushes. You know, as things unfolded, the dogs chased this thing into this dense thicket. And Gorman heard these agonized shrieks of the three animals.
Wow.
And then sudden silence. He was so scared when he heard that the yelping that he did not go down to investigate. He waited until the following morning. When he went down there, he found three large circles of dried out grass on the ground. And in the middle of each of those circles was this sort of gooey black mess that he surmised was the vaporized remains of his dogs. And it was That sort of terrorized the family, because not only were those three animals good cattle dogs, but they were also family pets. And so it was during that period in 1996 when the Gorman family decided that they finally had enough and that they wanted out. And it was at that stage that they began contacting people, and word got into the media, and through the media, Robert Bigelow and NIDS saw those stories and contacted the Gormans.
But to back up to the scariest stuff, and we'll be talking about some really dramatic incidents like that one, the scariest stuff to me in reading the reports were the tiny incidents that happened, poltergeist-type activity that started right from the beginning after the wolf incident, things disappearing, moving around on their own. The mom of the family goes shopping for groceries, comes home with a couple of weeks' worth of food, takes it out of the bags and puts it in the cabinets, goes to the bathroom, comes back, all the food is back out in the bags again.
Oh, no.
Or she would each morning take a shower. She'd lock the door in the bathroom, put her her hairbrush on top of the towel right next to the shower, get out of the shower. The door is still locked, but the brush and the towel are gone. Then find them later, like in the microwave or the freezer. The rancher, Tom Gorman, being out on the range, he would he was using a post hole digger on one day, stops from his work for just a second, either to brush his brow or to take a drink of water, turns back around, the post hole digger is gone. They find it days later, 30 feet up in a tree. Things of that sort, which we would categorize as poltergeist type activity. They started hearing disembodied voices above their heads speaking in a strange language, almost in mocking sort of tones. They would see shadowy type beings in the house. All the kinds of things that we would categorize as poltergeist stuff, but which, you know, frankly scares the hell out of me in thinking about it.
Well, you talk about flying objects. Can you rule out that there's any extraterrestrial intervention here?
Well, it's almost impossible to rule that out because the Gorman family sort of were deluged by different sizes and different kinds of objects, ranging from these huge triangular objects to like triangular flying objects to small intelligently guided orbs to there were small craft that looked like a mini version of the B-2 bomber or F-117 stealth fighter, very small versions of those. There were Mexican hat-shaped objects that were seen by the Gormans and by actually neighbors.
Well, but I don't understand, Colum, why, and we're coming up to the top of the hour, so we may save your answer, but in most cases, extraterrestrial visitations seem to be pretty benevolent. You know, yes, we have reports of abductions, but we don't have this horror that surrounds it. If anything, cattle mutilations may be done for some scientific or genetic reason. Who knows that yet? But in this particular case, there really seems to be some evil surrounded by it. That's at least my impression.
Well, that is one of the things that when we interviewed Junior Hicks, that he really pointed his finger at the property right in the middle of the Uinta Basin. He said in all of the years and decades of his investigations, the property that we're talking about was fairly unique, but because a lot of the events seemed like darker, they seemed more sinister than he was used to investigating.
Let's weigh both of that when we come back, that sinister darkness and then these extraterrestrial craft that they were seeing, because this is very, very, very interesting. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Colum, we were talking about the apparent demonic attacks on this ranch, and my thoughts were that if they were, you know, purely extraterrestrial visitations, I don't think they'd be that evil. So what's going on there?
Yeah, we really looked at a whole bunch of different hypotheses, including the so-called extraterrestrial hypothesis, and we gained the idea that maybe the military was sort of experimenting with exotic technology out there. We were exploring the idea of some kind of a dimensional phenomena. So we had a whole bunch of different, and we also explored, by the way, that the idea that the family had hoaxed everything. We explored the idea that both the family and the researchers on the property were hallucinating, and we ruled that out. In short, we never actually gained enough scientific evidence to really go down the route of the extraterrestrial hypothesis or go down the route of the interdimensional hypothesis. But what we did know was that there was a combination. It was not only dark incidents that were happening on this property. For example, on the very day that the Gormans had finally, they had sold the property and they were taking the last drive through the property, in broad daylight, they saw the silver disc that came low over the ridge, which was to the north of the property, flew right over the property, stopped, and as they both looked at it, and this was broad daylight, it just vanished in this brilliant sort of brilliant blast of light, and both of them felt the sort of happiness that they had never felt on that property. So, you know, it was not only sort of the dark, demonic kind of stuff that was happening, but there was also stuff that was not immediately sinister. It was not all completely dark.
Maybe they were just relieved, call them, to get out of there.
They were very, very relieved to get out of there. Yeah, but you know, there were other incidents that were not directly sort of attacking them, but by and large, I think they were feeling threatened, especially by the incidents that George had talked about, which is the day-to-day low-level poltergeist activity continually happening in their surroundings. And, you know, if you put those sort of day-to-day incidents against the backdrop of their economic situation, which is slowly going down the drain because of these spectacular mutilations and disappearance of their cattle, then you add two and two together, and by mid 1996, they really had made the decision to get the hell out of there.
You know, you look at the idea of whether or not it's evil, and you know, and we tackle that in the book. Frankly, we don't have enough information to answer it one way or another, and it certainly seems at times evil to us, to humans. The effects were dramatic and terrible on the family. I mean, they were a wreck by the time they finally got out of there. But you know what? We really can't even guess is if that was the intention of whatever was behind this. It had a trickster quality to it, you know, sometimes playful, always interactive, generally kind of clever, always one step ahead of both the family and the NIDS team, as if it was able to anticipate the next move. So we could see it as evil, and the effects, some of them were evil, but whether that was the intention or whatever was behind it, we can't even really surmise.
Well, once the Gorman family moved out then, sold the property, did the NIDS team that came in, including you, Colum, did you start experiencing some horrible things?
Well, it was pretty quick, actually, in August to September of 1996. We moved in an entire sort of command and control center. We moved in equipment, we moved in personnel. So the atmosphere on the property changed dramatically within that sort of August, September framework. You know, it was no longer a terrified family living in their, you know, in the single room for protection of their homestead. It was now people out there tramping on the fields, people with equipment out there at 2 and 3 a.m. trying to measure stuff. So within probably a month or two of being on the property, we were there all the time. We had instruments, so we did see some objects in the distance that were behaving unlike any aircraft, any satellite, any helicopter, any flying object that we'd ever seen. There were four witnesses to that first incident. It was distant, and it was certainly not in your face spectacular like the Gormans had been talking about, but it was a beginning. And then a couple of months later, myself and another physicist were outside the command and control center about 1 a.m. on a November night, and this object came in over the ranch. It was completely silent. It was moving at least at the speed of a jet fighter. It's impossible to tell either the altitude or the distance at night, obviously. But this thing came so quickly over the command and control center, did a 180 degrees, and then headed back north very, very quickly. By the time we got cameras to bear on the thing, it was moving right over the ridge, and we got one or two quick photographs of it. But, you know, a distant blur on a photograph is not really good for photographic analysis.
No. Were you convinced, though, Colum, that whatever you saw was physical as opposed to some kind of a dimensional illusion?
We really, at that early stage, and this was very, very early stage, September to November of 1996, those couple of incidents, really, there was no way of telling what they were. I mean, you know, it was, they didn't conform to anything we knew about. But, you know, as 1997 began to dawn, and sort of March 1997 came around, and we investigated the daylight dismemberment of a calf on the property within a couple of hundred feet of the command and control center, that was really something that got our attention, because it was the physical mutilation of an 84-pound calf in broad daylight, and the rancher and his wife were only 300 yards away. They were in the same field, having tagged the animal. This calf was completely devoid of internal organs. Its ribs were jutting into the sky. There was not a single drop of blood on the animal. And this all happened in broad daylight with the two people only 300 yards away. They did not see anything. They did not hear anything. The NIDS investigative team, including a veterinarian pathologist, arrived within hours of that incident. We were standing over the animal, did a complete necropsy, videotaped the crime scene, treated it exactly like a crime scene, a forensic, and did the usual forensics. Veterinary pathologist during the necropsy found that a sharp instrument had been used to remove the ear, took samples, sent them to two independent labs, and the labs came up with exactly the same thing. Sharp instruments had been used to dismember that calf in broad daylight with a couple of witnesses, 300 yards, you know.
And I'm sure, had there been somebody there doing this, they would have seen him, right?
Well, that was definitely what we took from it. And, you know, immediately as part of the investigation, we engaged a professional tracker whose business, who makes a living actually, you know, tracking. That tracker went through the property at a radius of a quarter of a mile around the dead calf. And found no tracks to speak
Nothing.
Of that were,
that's
you know, discernible.
Absolutely staggering. Okay, so when the NIDS group took over the ranch and some of the people started moving in there for testing purposes, what kind of equipment did they bring in? What was the method to start figuring out what was going on there?
Since this was a 480-acre property, you know, we decided that the best way to cover this property was to have portable equipment to be ready at the drop of the hat to go a couple of or a mile or two this way or that way. So we had a variety of electric field, magnetic field detectors, alpha, beta, gamma X-ray detectors. We had digital camcorders and cameras. We had night vision technology, but we also had a handheld spectrometer, which was hooked up to a laptop. We had a Fresnel lens to collect light through a spectrometer, which would dump in real-time data onto a laptop. Any analysis of unusual lights on the property. The reason that was important is that for 50 years, people have been trying to obtain spectra, real spectra from the so-called UFO phenomenon. Based on the idea that if you know what chemical elements go into making a light, you have at least some idea of what's behind that light. So we had this portable spectrometer that we carried with us in addition to all of this equipment. So it was not the usual sort of investigation that people normally carry out into these phenomena. We were fully funded and fully equipped due to the vision and the largesse of Robert Bigelow.
Sure. What other incidents, George, were out there of the horrible kind?
Well, I'll tell you one that's very disturbing, and it goes back to what I was saying about the trickster quality of this phenomena.
Okay.
And it dealt with the bulls. The family had these four prized bulls, 2,000 pounds each, very valuable animals. And at this point, the rancher and his wife had already lost a big chunk of their herd. They're driving to town, and they comment to each other almost in an offhand way, man, if we lose one of these bulls, we're in serious trouble. They come back a short time later. All four of the bulls are gone. They're out of the corral. They're gone. They're missing. So they're sort of panicked. They start looking around for the animals. Inside this corral is this metal trailer that's used for storage purposes. There's only one way into it. This door is locked. It's wired with this thick wire. And so the rancher, he can't find the bulls, almost on a whim, peeks up into this tiny little slit at the top of the corral, at the top of the trailer, and looks inside. There are all four of the bulls crammed inside this trailer up against each other, almost as if in a trance. Now, these are powerful animals, surly animals. You'd have a heck of a time getting one of them in, let alone all four of them. He yells to his wife, hey, they're in here. And when he makes that sound, the bulls wake up out of this trance and start kicking the heck out of the sides of this thing. it really goes back to the trickster quality. The animals weren't harmed, but it was clear that something was really messing with their minds. There was an additional incident that that really is disturbing. When Colum and the team were there, where they saw these gigantic eyes perched in the top of this tree. I mean, giant cat-like eyes. And there was some other object, animal on the ground, large bear-type thing, Bigfoot-type thing. The rancher takes off in his truck with his gun. Colum and another scientist were following in another vehicle. The rancher jumps out and point-blank fires at these animals. He's sure that he hit both of them. Something falls out of the tree. The object, the animal, whatever it was on the ground, basically disappears. At the time, it was winter. There was snow still on the ground. So the team grabs flashlights and starts chasing. And it's a statement to the bravery of the team and the rancher. They start chasing what they think is a large wounded animal. They find a giant footprint in the snow. It's like a raptor. It's this three-toed thing, but Colum can describe it better than I. They never found another footprint, never found any blood, but in essence, it was like a dinosaur in this tree. And that also, like the wolf, was bulletproof. Pretty scary stuff.
Oh, Colum, could these have been extraterrestrials? I mean, you know, we've heard the stories of reptilians and things like that. Or do you think it's something else?
Well, the problem with these animals or whatever they were was they had the nasty habit of leaving absolutely the minimum of evidence behind that we could we could go after, and that's why NIDS was really set up was to use the scientific method and forensic methodology to go after whatever evidence was left. So, you know, we were left with a single footprint in the incident that George just described. Luckily, we had a body from the calf to go after, and we used the best in forensics to establish that, you know, this was not sort of some kind of predator arriving. This was a sharp instruments were used on the calf that was dismembered. You know, and actually, interestingly, the incident that George has just described happened two nights after the dismemberment of that calf, and it happened in very close proximity to where the calf had been taken apart. So we think, or we hypothesized at least, that those two incidents were part of a continuum of, you know, high strangeness on the property. But in terms of, you know, nailing down, okay, was what was happening, quote unquote, extraterrestrial? Was it interdimensional? The kinds of fleeting evidence that were left behind were not able to grab on and to test and eliminate hypotheses given the dearth of evidence from this particular incident.
What's happening to the property today? Who owns it? What's going on there?
NIDS still owns the property. It's still being under 100% surveillance, 724. There are two personnel on the property who are watching all of the time. They report to NIDS. So it's an ongoing surveillance operation. It is at a much lower level than was happening in 96, 97, and 98. But the research still continues.
Are bizarre things still happening there?
There are sort of peaks and valleys. There are still things happening there, yes.
We should point out that the whole scenario changed when NIDS arrived and took up residence and the family left. I mean, instead of the family being terrorized and hunted, the NIDS team was hunting whatever this thing was, and it seemed to indicate that it didn't like it. There was one very dramatic incident that happened, almost a statement from this phenomena or intelligence, that it didn't like being photographed. NIDS had established a series of wide-ranging video equipment on the top of telephone poles that could cover a great deal of the pasture and the ranch and look for evidence of whatever popped up. Well, something went up one of these poles, ripped out the guts of the video gear, tore out all the wires. Not only did that, but the wires had been attached to the telephone pole with this thick tape that had been baked in the sun. It took all that tape away as well. Well, when this incident occurred, the team immediately realized, hey, we've got other cameras that could focus on this pole. We should be able to back up the tape, figure out the time it happened, and we'll see whatever or whoever did this. When they backed up the tape, they basically saw nothing. Whatever did it was invisible. I think there was some subsequent photo analysis or heightened visual quality column. What did you see?
Well, we brought all of the tapes back to Las Vegas, and this happened at 8:30 at night in the summer, so there was still enough light in order to increase the resolution by digital analysis. When we increased the resolution, we could actually see the tiny red lights underneath the video cameras going off as power was cut from the three cameras. But at the same time, there was no evidence of anything living or otherwise near those cameras as they lost power. Now, the resolution was good enough to see the lights going off. It was not good enough to see the actual wiring being ripped out of the cameras, but we could correlate almost exactly the timestamps on all three video cameras that lost power and correlate it with the timestamp on the camera that was watching the three cameras as they lost power, and they both matched exactly. So there was no monkeying around with time in this whole thing. I mean, the simple fact of the matter was that something ripped out the wiring in full view as it was being filmed, in full view, and it was not visible on the film.
And the lesson we've sort of derived from that is whatever this thing is or was doesn't like to be photographed, doesn't like to be hunted, and it was making a sort of a definitive statement to that effect. I mean, because that's when things sort of went underground. Whatever it is kind of went into hibernation. The dramatic incidents decreased to the point where NIDS no longer felt it was necessary to have Colum and his colleagues up there 24/7. And so that's where it is now.
And it's obvious that this creature, whatever it may be, this entity, doesn't want anybody around. We'll be back in a moment with Colum Kelleher, George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. And those of you just popping in, we're talking with Colum Kelleher and George Knapp about an incredible story at a remote Utah ranch. Strange things occurred there over the years, still do. The National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS, owns the property now. George and Colum, I'm going to ask you both just to step out a little bit and give us your own conclusions on just what the heck you think has been going on this ranch. Colum, we'll start with you first. What do you think? What's your gut tell you?
Well, my gut tells me that there was something that during 1997, when the NIDS investigators were on the property, every time we were on the property, something was happening, you know, and there's a litany of incidents beginning in March 1997 going all the way through. That's something did appear to have some kind of an intelligence. And what that intelligence was, I still have no idea. But there was a sense during that six-month period in 1997 when all hell was breaking loose. Every time we were on the property, stuff was happening. We were engaging, chasing these orbs of light around a particular homestead in the middle of the property. Red orbs were attacking cattle. The strange creatures were appearing, disappearing. We had a really spectacular incident with a black humanoid type creature crawling through some kind of a tunnel, visible in infrared, but not visible with the normal cameras. All of that added up to some kind of an intelligence phenomenon. Now, was this a Grand Central Station? Did it happen to be just some kind of a location that attracted a whole bunch of diverse and unrelated phenomena? We have no way of knowing. But we do know that what was ever on this property is potentially intelligent and should be investigated further by science. I mean, one of the reasons that we wrote this book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, is to begin to ask folks that perhaps this is the kind of stuff that should be looked at by science in the future rather than sticking to the straight and narrow of mainstream science. This kind of phenomena needs to be investigated as a door to opening the discovery process. I mean, after all, it is the discovery of the study of anomalies that does automatically lead to the discovery process. And it can actually catapult the discovery process.
Sure. George, how about you? What about
your
thoughts?
Well, you know, same sort of a theme. I mean, it definitely is an intelligence. It seems capable of manipulating events and matter and minds in ways that we really don't understand. It provides tantalizing hints and tidbits of information about a new understanding of reality. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line of the book without firm conclusions, is that this kind of seems to be pointing the way toward some new kind of understanding, maybe leading us down a path to a new understanding of the world around us. Maybe it's that the fact that there are other dimensions, that there are other intelligences, that we're a small part of a very big picture. And again, it's worthy of study by people certainly smarter than me. If we can add anything to the larger picture, it's that people need to take this stuff seriously. And I think when the lessons of the ranch and subsequent studies, hopefully subsequent studies, hit us all, it's going to be a mind-numbing, dramatic, fundamental change in the way we view the world around us. And something on the level of the Copernican Revolution, I think it's going to be dramatic.
What do you think it, I sound like Stephen King here, what do you think it wants?
Well, it could be sort of toying with us, giving us hints, maybe a little bit at a time, not to lead us too fast toward these conclusions. It may have been going on for a long time. I the fact that it incorporates UFOs, Bigfoot, poltergeist, cattle mutilations, Indian native lore, things of that sort, almost hints that all of this stuff may be somehow interrelated, that there's a new way to look at this that we just haven't figured out yet.
Did you two ever think about bringing exorcists, psychics, remote viewers, anybody else like that had this kind of sensitivity to the paranormal on the ranch?
Well, that happened, Colum.
Yes, actually, we employed several different remote viewers at different times to specifically investigate the question you just asked. And we had some absolutely uncannily accurate descriptions of the property from people who never visited the property. You know, they were given the usual geographical coordinates, as remote viewers do, and they were asked, to visualize what was going on. And one person in particular in 1997 drew the most accurate picture of the ranch I've ever seen, sight unseen, just by the geographical coordinates. Other remote viewers actually explored the property, walked around. NIDS at the time was definitely focused on the scientific method, but we were definitely also open to using whatever armamentarium that the remote viewers could provide us with, to provide leads, to provide new directions for research, to focus on specific locations for employing surveillance cameras or whatever. The bottom line is we were totally open to using remote viewers.
Were there ever any eyewitnesses to touchdowns of craft or anything like this? I know earlier you were talking about seeing three, like almost like burned out areas where the dogs ran into the woods, but any specific hard evidence there?
Well, there were, when we went onto the property, the Gorman family gave us a tour, and there were several locations on the property where these gigantic scoop marks had removed about 200 pounds of soil from the ground, and by the time we got to them, they were a couple of months old. But you could definitely see the indentations. And according to the family, when they first discovered them, it was like this gigantic cookie cutter had just come into the soil and removed 200 pounds. So that was a set of incidents that happened before the NIDS team actually arrived on the property. But while we were on the property, there were no obvious incidents of touchdowns on the property.
There was one very dramatic incident early in the Gormans' tenure on the property. Their first what we would call UFO incident. There was what they thought was an RV. There's only one way to get onto the property. They saw this what looked like a big square-looking recreational vehicle down in one of the pastures. And the rancher said to his son, "Well, somebody got lost. Let's go down there and help them out." And as they're walking toward this thing, its lights are on, what they thought were headlights, and it starts moving toward them kind of slowly. And then as it's moving toward them, it starts rising off the ground and floated over the treetops and out into the sky and out of sight. That was the, I believe, Colin, their first what we would call UFO experience.
Yeah, that's right. And as it took off over the trees, it was perfectly silhouetted against the western sky. The thing looked like basically a large flying refrigerator. I mean, in terms of aerodynamics, where does that come from?
Now, that's a pretty big area, 400-plus acres. But were there other reports of UFO landings or anything like that on other neighbors' property?
Oh, yes, definitely. We actually, as part of the investigation, we interviewed all of the neighbors. We interviewed dozens and dozens of people stretching in, miles radius around the property. And we came up with dozens and dozens of different stories of objects landing on the property, close encounters with objects, Mexican hat-shaped UFOs that were seen by the neighbors just down the way, like a few hundred yards from where the command and control center was. So there was a litany of different types of craft that were seen by different people over the previous 10, 20, 30 years in the Uinta Basin, and specifically within a couple of hundred yard radius of the ranch. Multiple witnesses had seen those things.
Well, both of you, great job on the work, Hunt for the Skinwalker. What's been the reaction to the book so far?
Well, I mean, the public is certainly interested. We don't have any sales figures, but it's got a lot of chatter. A lot of people are talking about it. It's doing pretty well on Amazon.com. We've had some distribution problems, at least here in Las Vegas, and a lot of folks saying that they can't get it. A lot of discussion on internet sites and different chat groups, generally favorable. Some people have taken us to task for a couple of things that were beyond our control, one being that we're unable to use the real names of the people involved, at least some of the people involved. Gorman is not the name of the family, and it really boils down to a promise that NIDS made to this family after they'd been terrorized and were completely decimated by their experiences. Colum and his team had promised, hey, we're not going to do anything that's going to draw any more attention to you folks. They've since left the state. They're living somewhere else and trying to start a new life, and didn't want this to follow them, so we've kept our promise. And that's bothered some people that we don't reveal the real names. It's bothered some people that we don't have photographs in the book because there were a lot of photographs taken. It's not a real complicated story about why that didn't happen. My experiences on the ranch, I was looking to produce a video documentary. I'm thinking as a TV guy and didn't have still photos. So if we had been able to take the photos that I should have taken during my earlier visits, they would have been in the book. A lot of photos were taken by the NIDS team. They were owned by NIDS, and by the time we got permission to use them, it was too late to get them in the book. But it's no secret what the real names of the family are. They've been published before NIDS got on the scene. It's no secret what the ranch looks like because a lot of photos have been published. So people are kind of nitpicking about it, but honestly, this was an honest effort. The stuff that NIDS did is what science is supposed to do, and they should be applauded for it and not criticized. I mean, scientists are supposed to investigate the unexplained and not explain the uninvestigated. These guys, took this on knowing full well that that they were putting their careers on the line, that it's tough to get a job working in a government lab or a university after you have this kind of a thing on your resume because of the stigma attached to it. But this is what scientists should do.
Is there going to be a TV show here or a program?
Well, I started working on the documentary in 2002 with the permission of Mr. Bigelow and with the help of Colum. We've documented and photographed every inch of the ranch, interviewed a lot of the folks who've seen things, accumulated an incredible amount of info, and yeah, I'm working on a documentary right now.
When might we see it, George?
I would say early March.
Very good. That's not too far away, is it? This year's already going by. Here we go. Well, I'll tell you what, George, let's take the next 5 minutes or so, talk a little bit about Area 51, and then we'll take phone calls next hour with you and Cullum. You've got a lot of experience with Area 51, extremely infamous area. What do you, at this point now in your career, and with the years of experience, what do you think has been and is going on there?
Well, I at this point, I would say that there really were some craft out there at one point. Area 51, as you know...
And you're talking about extraterrestrial craft.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, I can't prove it, but, you know, and I'm not just basing this on Bob Lazar's story. He's a controversial figure in ufology, and for better or worse, I'm the guy that unleashed him on the world. But he's not the only source. Over the years, I have more than 24 people who've worked at the base at different times, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who've all told me bits and pieces of the same story, that they've seen the craft out there, these disc-shaped craft, classic flying saucers, either flying or in hangars and sequestered away, and I believe them. You know, it's not something that we're ever going to be able to prove. I don't think the government's ever going to open the doors and say, here are the flying saucers, come in and kick the tires. But these are people who told me their stories under duress, who were extremely worried about what would happen to them if their identities were revealed. And I got to know them, some of them pretty well. Many of them were, after they telephoned me and we talked, were visited by government agents who scared the hell out of them and told them to keep their mouths shut. I mean, one right after another. I think something really was going on out there. A lot of folks chalk it up to a disinformation exercise, a psychological warfare. Maybe they were trying to, distract attention from something that really was going on. Well, if that was the case, it was a miserable failure because as a result of my stories, I mean, tens of thousands of people have trekked out into the desert to see whatever it is that's flying around out there. Every major news organization in the world has visited the property, even though for a long time they gave me a pretty bad time about it and still do. And I think it was there for a while. Where it is now, I have no idea. There's too much attention on the base, I think, to reasonably think that it's still there.
Do you remember the movie Independence Day?
Sure.
And they took the alien to that Area 51 area. I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of what might have been going on there.
Well, it's pretty close, I think. You know, I remember watching a special premiere of that movie that they had in Las Vegas, and people were watching the part where the Secretary of Defense finally tells the president, yeah, well, there really is an Area 51, and maybe we had aliens out there, and the audience sort of, they all nudge each other. See, it's true, you know, that they needed a movie to convince them that this was really going on. I think it was, and I've taken a lot of grief over it over the years, but so be it.
At this point, do you believe that Bob Lazar indeed was who he says he is?
Well, I do, and I know there are weaknesses in his story, which I've admitted from the beginning. I have a hard time believing that he ever got the degrees that he claimed to have earned, because the paper trail just doesn't prove it. But I lived through a lot of this stuff with Bob. There were people following us around for a long time. They were bugging phones, broke into his house, did a lot of crazy stuff, and I think that he's telling the truth as he knows it. Now, whether or not they messed with his head, well, I think there's a pretty good chance that they did. But I believe that he is telling the truth as he knows it.
George, somewhere along the line, we've got to figure out a way where you can be a correspondent and do some reports for us here on Coast to Coast. I know you're very busy with your television responsibilities, but because you're down in that area that we're very interested in, we got to work something out with you.
Happy to do it. You tell me how.
Okay. Well, let's think about that. I'll powwow with Lisa, and we'll see what we can come up with, because I definitely would like you to be part of Coast to Coast. I mean, you are what we always need here, and that's a good, solid news person with an investigative mind who understands this area. And not a lot of people do, as you well know.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, Cullum, one, we're going to keep you next hour for phone calls along with you, George Knapp. And when you want to call and talk to both of them, you can talk about this ranch in Utah. You can talk with George about Area 51 or anything else. As you know, Cullum Kelleher has also talked about crop formations on this program before. He's done a number of series of work there. Cullum, anything new in that arena?
As far as I know, the formations are continuing in the United Kingdom. I have not really looked into it for many, many years now, actually. A lot of the work I was really focused on towards the latter end of National Institute for Discovery Science was using forensics to look at the cattle mutilation phenomenon. And I think if the history will look at the National Institute for Discovery Science, I think kindly, in that it will really sort of roll out the carpet on the forensic applications to the study of cattle mutilation.
All right, well, stick with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll open up the phone lines. Our guests, George Knapp, investigative reporter, award winner, and Colm Kelleher, researcher, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And back to George Knapp and Colm Kelleher and your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. George, what shift do you have now? What shows do you anchor in Las Vegas?
I'm not anchoring anymore. I'm strictly the chief investigative guy, but I don't have a regular shift. I mean, my hours are supposed to be like 9 to 6, but I basically work all the time.
Whatever it takes.
Yep.
Been there. Colm, what's new for you? What's on your plate?
Well, right now I'm working in a biotechnology company in San Francisco, and I think like George, I'm basically working around the clock. It's a nice change from Las Vegas, but definitely a challenge.
And how did you get your name, George? I was named after my father's father.
Same thing. I'm the fourth George in a row.
Okay, good for you. Let's go to
good the name, friends. Right?
Absolutely, it's different. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on the air. Hi there.
Good morning, George. How you doing? Another fascinating show. This is Jim from Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, Jim. Good to have you with us.
And good morning, George. Good morning, Colm.
Good morning.
I have a kind of a hypothesis that I'm thinking about throwing out to you guys based on what you were talking about here. And earlier when you were talking about how you noticed that the people that were on the ranch noticed how things were appearing, and they'd go tracking them, and they'd kind of just disappear on them, and they'd have no trace of them. They couldn't explain where they went. What I was thinking was maybe, and I was wondering if you guys had maybe thought about this, you know, being that this has been going on for a while, or that people were thinking that this has been going on clear back into the 1800s or even earlier, is it possible that this site could have been or is the site of like an interdimensional gateway that is allowing things to pass, you know, back and forth between another dimension to ours, and that would explain how things are able to just kind of blip in and out of our existence and into wherever, you know?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and, you know, one of the things that we didn't talk about on the in the previous 2 hours was something that Tom Gorman, the rancher, used to look at in the evenings from on his property, and that was a large orange object that used to kind of float over the about a mile away over an old abandoned homestead on his property. And so he used to set up his rifle scope right outside his homestead and look at this thing very carefully to see what the hell it was, because it was there sort of very, very often. And on one particular evening, he was looking through this thing, through his scope at this thing, when he saw a different sky through this orange object. And he swore that it was like a blue sky, and this was late in the evening where he was, but he could see a blue sky almost like another world. He was looking into another world through some kind of a hole in the sky. That's how he described it to me. Now, as he was watching through his scope, he saw a tiny black object moving very, very fast in his direction, and it was getting bigger and bigger, moving at incredible speed. And as he watched, it seemed to fly through this from the lighted sky section over into the dark sky. It was moving so quickly. Once it moved into close to where he was, it vanished into the night. But he swore that there was some kind of a dimensional phenomenon that he was watching. So, you know, I think your question's a very good one.
In addition, I mean, we would put that at the top of the list, that it's some kind of a portal or, you know, the Irish, like Colm, have a saying about places where the world is thin, and that seems to be an apt description for the ranch, because as Colm mentioned early in the interview, there were all these different kinds of animals that were seen on the property that came from somewhere else, exotic birds that looked like they would be at home in the Amazon. There was another creature that was seen. It looked like a hyena, a 200- or 300-pound hyena, heavily muscled, that was attacking a horse, just kind of toying with it, that left wounds on the horse. It wasn't a hyena because it had this giant bushy tail. The rancher grabbed his gun, was chasing it, and this thing basically took off and disappeared. There were a lot of creatures like that that seemed to be on the ranch that came from somewhere else. And so as a scientist, Colm can't say it's an interdimensional portal, but as a journalist, I have more leeway, and that's at the top of my list.
Great. Well, I just wanted to say that I think you guys are doing a heck of a job, and I really appreciate all the work you guys are doing. And, George, I love the show. I've been listening to it a lot of years.
Thank you,
Chad. Again, a really great show. Thanks a lot, guys.
Appreciate you and your question. By the way, George Knapp, the folks at the NighthawkZone.com chat room, would like to know that John Lear is there listening to you as you speak tonight.
John's a great guy, and I owe him a lot.
Small world, isn't it?
Yep.
First-time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How are we doing?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to give you some information about, I heard you talking about Area 51, and I used to work for the United States Air Force back in 2003, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And I was part of if you're familiar with the security forces.
Sure.
And we're basically the Air Force's cops. And a friend of mine that I went to tech school with, he works at Area 51, and as far as I know, last time I talked to him, he's still working with that particular base. And you're right when you said that they probably have moved all of their operations out of that base. They have. And from what information I do have and can tell you, it's somewhere in Colorado now. And apparently, from what I've heard, is it has some connection with the NORAD defense center there.
It's probably underneath the Denver airport.
And wouldn't doubt it. But in my time as being security forces, I've done the stuff. I've looked after our nuclear weapons and whatnot, but never got the chance to go to 51.
Did you ever see any objects hover over the nuclear sites at all?
No, but a lot of my coworkers did, and they swore up and down that we were all getting attacked by little green men with space guns,
and they were darn serious, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And to tell you the truth, what my friend was telling me about Area 51 is you're saying about the flying saucer type craft. That from what he told me when I last saw him. That is true. The Air Force was working on a project that required the craft to be in a shape like a saucer because it's more surface area to put a lot of equipment on. And apparently they were trying a new type of propulsion, and it has something to do with electromagnetic propulsion.
Sounds like anti-gravity.
Yes,
yeah, real new.
Exactly. You know how you take a magnet, North Pole and a South Pole, you put the two North Poles together and they repel each other.
You got
right?
it. Yep.
That's the same type of thing they're doing. The reason they had to make it in a circle or a disc shape is because they can fit all of the whatever equipment they need to use that on there. And so.
Well, somewhere along the lines, this story is going to bust loose. And I hope we're part of it when it does happen. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. You know, George Knapp, on some of these UFO sightings that people see, the object is rotating within itself. And I wonder if that has anything to do with the propulsion system.
Well, I'm not an expert in that area, but Bob Lazar could better address the question. The craft that he described were all sort of solid objects, and I don't recall him describing anything that sort of rotated around itself, but that's not entirely removed from some of the objects that were seen at the ranch. Would you agree, Colm?
Yeah, and I know the other hotspot that we spent a lot of time in was northern New Mexico around Dulce, which coincidentally also has an Apache, a Native American population, but We interviewed probably 200 separate eyewitnesses over quite a period of time. Many of them said the same thing, that they were, you know, that these circular objects would come over Mount Archuleta or come over some area near Dulce, and they would be spinning underneath. You know, they were that narrative was very, very common.
Hey, I want to share a story with you, George, about the security forces at Area 51.
Sure.
I had done all these stories, of course, and it caused innumerable headaches for those guys out there because of all the people that try to get on the base or sneak onto it or take photos, and they're always chasing us out. They've chased me out of there many, many times. A couple of years ago, the Area 51 guys went on strike, and I got these anonymous calls that said, hey, show up at the Janet terminal at McCarran Airport. There's a really interesting development, and I go out there, and there are the guys in their camo uniforms holding picket signs because they felt they were being unfairly treated. I was a little bit tenuous about approaching them because I'd caused them so much trouble over the years, got out of the car, and they embraced me like I was a celebrity or something. All of a sudden, I'm taking photos with them and signing autographs and thanking me for supporting their union action. A lot of them had these little alien pins on their uniforms. Maybe it was a joke, maybe it wasn't. A couple of hours after my story aired, they were all contacted and were told to knock it off or they would be stripped of their security clearances. But a couple of them told me, hey, watch a couple of days from now. We're going to send you something. And 2 days later, somebody dropped off at the TV station my own camo uniform from Area 51.
There you go.
A nice little gesture.
I love it. Back to the phones. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hello. And George and Colm. How are y'all this morning?
Good evening.
Good, thanks.
We're doing well.
My name is Carrie, and I'm calling from Western North Carolina. One of you, I believe it was George, had mentioned when you were describing this entity at the ranch as it being sort of a trickster. And that rang a bell in my head. And I got to thinking about it, and I don't know if it's just particular to the Cherokee or all Native American peoples, but isn't there a entity or spirit or something that they call the trickster? And I believe its name is Loki, L-O-K-I.
Well, the trickster phenomena is in many cultures. It's throughout Native American lore in different variations, but it's throughout the world. Different variations, call them leprechauns, call them fairies, pixies, whatever. Jacques Vallée has written extensively about that. We address that in the book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, because it sort of feeds into the trickster mentality that was demonstrated at the ranch.
Right, because, you know, the trickster is supposedly able to shapeshift and be invisible, and it just sounded so much like what you were describing. And, you know, when you said the word trickster, it made me think of that. And I just wanted to ask, you know, if you had looked into that, but obviously you have. So
absolutely. It fits perfectly with what we're describing.
It definitely does. Well, gentlemen, thank you for a very interesting show. And y'all have a very wonderful night.
Okay, thank you. And I want the world to know, George, while you broadcast out of Las Vegas and you're on the phone with us there, the Monster KXNT, our number one rated station there in Las Vegas, 840 on the AM dial, is carrying your melodious voice, George Knapp, as we speak.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'll have to drop by and say hi to them.
Yes, do that. East of the Rockies, welcome to the program. You're on the air. Hi there.
This is Phil, and I'm calling from Chicago.
Hi, Phil.
WLS.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
The reason I'm calling is because several years ago, I have a friend that's living down in Kentucky, and she's an extremely gifted clairvoyant, and she started experiencing like energy shifts on her property, and she started seeing the orbs that you gentlemen are talking about. Mm. And her husband was actually out on their property chasing what she described as approximately a 6-foot black character, very thin and running very quickly, almost skimming over the surface with a dog's head. And and she was warned by her let's call them guides to leave it alone. And I happened to go out and visit her right around the time this was happening, and she actually showed me some of the tracks in the snow, and the tracks appear like it wasn't entirely touching the ground, you know, like it would, there was too much distance between them. And her theory was that it was like some kind of dimensional warp. And I guess the reason I felt necessary to call was because I think you guys are on the right track, and I'm wondering if you have done any energy measurements in that area.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the dog's head in particular is striking, because one of the people we interviewed from the Ute tribe, who is also a security guard, worked as a security guard in the area, described exactly what you've just described, right down to the dog's head, that there were two individuals in the middle of the local town, Fort Duchesne, and he described these individuals with dog's heads. So that's one part of the overlap. The second is we did a lot of measurements on the property, specifically for magnetic field perturbations, and we did find there was many occasions when compasses would go wild. We found a lot of unexplained increases in magnetic fields that would go away quickly. Some of the phenomena were actually associated with changes in magnetic field. For example, on one occasion, something invisible basically charged through the a herd of cattle, scattering them in all kinds of directions. And one of the individuals there happened to have a compass and found that the compass locked onto whatever was charging through the herd of animals, and it remained locked on long after the animals had scattered, and stayed like that for about 9 minutes.
To elaborate on the story about the dog's heads, this security guard and his partner were patrolling the area near the ranch, and they at night, and came around this corner, and their headlights showed these two figures, looked like men in trench coats. They looked closer, and these men had dog's heads, and they were smoking cigarettes. Colum and I debated about whether or not to put that in the book, because it's so incredible and hard to believe, but the guys jumped out. As soon as they jumped out of their car, these beings disappeared, but the cigarettes were left on the ground.
Bizarre.
It's kind of goofy, but we've had two different independent witnesses who've told us about seeing these dog's heads beings, and we just chalked it up to skinwalkers.
Is it possible that this is sacred ground here? Maybe it's been a burial site. Who knows what? Is that possible?
I know there's a long tradition in the Ute arena to avoid the property. And actually, there's Tom Gorman, the rancher, used to tell us about this good friend of his who's a Navajo, came to visit him one time and stopped at the gate, basically. Would not go on the property because it was the opposite of sacred ground. It was cursed. And this whole Path of the Skinwalker legend that gave rise to the title of the book is the same thing. The in general, and this is not, you know, 100%, but in general, members of the local and Native American tribe do not tend to congregate on that property.
We'll be back. Final phone calls with George Knapp and Colum Kelleher and you on Coast to Coast AM. How did you come up, Colum and George, with that name, Hunt for the Skinwalker? How come you didn't say Hunt for the Extraterrestrial or Hunt for something like that? Why Skinwalker?
Well, I think it came from the Junior Hicks. We did a lot of interviewing of Junior Hicks, who told us that the ranch was on the path of the Skinwalker. And the Skinwalker is a really good, we think, umbrella metaphor for this Grand Central Station aspect of the Utah Ranch. It covers basically everything from poltergeist activity to nuts and bolts type UFO type activity, and discarnate voices like hauntings, like Bigfoot activity. So everything that you can imagine in the paranormal sphere seems to have happened at one time or another on this particular property. So the Skinwalker is really in our hands, at least, as a metaphor for this wide-ranging activity, but it is also linked directly in with the Ute and Navajo legends in the area. And George Knapp named his original two articles on Skinwalker in 2002, which really raised the profile of the ranch.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. We've got more calls than time. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Run away with it. Go ahead.
Area 51, I've read and heard from several different sources, is being highlighted to keep the heat off of the Dulce base in New Mexico, which is supposed to be pretty involved.
Well, Colum would have to address that question because he spent a lot of weeks, a lot of months down in Dulce. We've all heard the stories about a Dulce base, and while I don't find them especially credible, there certainly is a legacy of strange activity in that area reported by the Apaches and local residents.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree with what George has just said. The Dulce area is a real center. It's a hot spot of a huge amount of activity. And we were fortunate enough to have a retired patrol officer named Gabe Valdez as part of the NIDS investigative team for several years. And he was the person who had investigated cattle mutilations in northern New Mexico all the way back in the 1980s. And so he was familiar with a lot of what was happening. When we went to investigate that whole area, Gabe Valdez basically opened all of the doors into the upper echelons of the Icoreta Apache tribe in Dulce, and got us to talk to people who would never ever go on the record. And he also got us to the tribal elders and some of the people who were in the shaman tradition of the tribe. So it was a very privileged experience from the National Institute for Discovery Science perspective. But the bottom line of all of our investigations in Dulce was that there was a huge amount of disparate activity, including unusual animals, including Sasquatch sightings, and also unidentified flying objects. But there was never any concrete indication of the quote-unquote alien base. We could not find any evidence for that.
Now, with the unusual animals, how does the chupacabra fit into all this? Because when I was in Puerto Rico in the early 60s, there were no stories of anything that went bump in the night. And then we've got this the story of this thing that started, I guess, in the 80s.
Yeah. The chupacabra is kind of, there's certainly animals that attack horses and cattle, as we've actually discussed earlier on the program, associated with the property. Whether or not they are associated with this chupacabra phenomenon, we don't know. But actually, the National Institute for Discovery Science did send an investigator to Puerto Rico to investigate some of the chupacabra sightings. And he came away with a lot of weird, very weird experiences, actually, surreal, but never could nail down anything concrete.
Yeah. Seems to be centered pretty much around the mountainous region, around the Anvil, El Yunque, they call it.
Okay.
There's a lot of sightings around that particular region.
Well, there appears to be some all around the country, too, as well. They're bizarre stories, but you did not get any of those reports on this ranch, I take it, right?
We did have reports of animals, you know, the unusual animal that the hyena-like creature,
right,
that George described attacking the horses. But specifically, we did not find any overlap with the chupacabra. We did investigate a case. The National Institute for Discovery Science investigated a case in Duchesne, Utah, which is not all that far from the property, where there was multiple horses extremely severely mauled, and that the local game and fish officer ruled out standard predators. We could never find out what had actually perpetrated those acts.
Is NIDS still functioning?
NIDS is on ice in terms of investigations.
Yeah, that's what I had heard.
Just over a year ago, but it could be reactivated at any moment, and that is subject to the to Robert Bigelow's decision.
Right. Isn't he now contemplating building space hotels? Wasn't that what he was thinking about?
Well, he is more than contemplating. He sometime this year will probably be one of the first private entrepreneurs to launch a privately owned space station in orbit. And that one of those launches is probably going to happen in the year 2006. So he has a team of close to 100 engineers from the aerospace industry focused in Las Vegas and in Houston, Texas. And the name of the game is to build the first privately owned space station.
He has put an incredible amount of money of his own out of his own pocket into this process. I'm maybe the only TV reporter allowed into his facility, and I've been out there a lot of times. It's an absolutely incredible undertaking, and Bob Bigelow, you know, in the UFO field, which has a sort of a conspiracy bent anyway, he's seen as a shadowy guy with all kinds of connections. He's not a shadowy guy. He's here in Las Vegas. He's well known. He's a philanthropist and a successful businessman, and he has taken this from this idea of a space habitat from zero to where it's ready to go. I mean, it would already have been launched in November if the launch facility had been ready. But Bigelow and his team are ready to go. He's got NASA scientists working for him, and believe me, you know, in this race to get the first habitat up there, it'll be Bigelow, not Branson, who wins.
Is Bigelow the one that the movie Contact was based on? Remember the guy who financed Jodie Foster's efforts? Was that based on him, maybe?
Oh, that's an interesting angle. Not to my knowledge, no.
You never know what's going on.
I mean,
you know,
same kind of character, but no.
You do know, George, we're going to send you up on one of these flights so you can report back for us.
I'm ready to go. I'm staying close to Bigelow, too.
Oh, yeah. If you know him, you might as well go, and heck, we'll take a feed with you.
Somebody's got to go.
Yep, absolutely. Maybe we'll send you and Richard Hoagland. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coaster on the Air. Hi there.
Hi, Jack Davis.
Hi, Jack. Go ahead, sir.
Scappoose, Oregon.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of things have been discussed the last few minutes that I was concerned about, the all this investment in property and equipment and any scientific proof of anything going on other than hearsay.
Well, I would say that there's a lot of physical evidence that came out of the NID study of the ranch. The mutilated animals certainly were physical evidence of something. There were wounds on other animals as well. There were wounds on the family that we really haven't discussed, not terrible wounds, but definitive physical imprints of something. There were tracks on the grounds that were found from the object that was shot out of the tree. There were the bulls being stuffed into the trailer, the attack on the cameras. There was also something that we've dubbed an ice circle. So there was a lot of physical evidence as well as photographic evidence.
Well,
and
the whole thing, but the photographic, I would think with all the equipment you had available, that you would have been able to get something definitive. Most of what you said is hearsay. The bulls, there was no picture of the bulls in the trailer. Somebody told you that, right?
Well, I would have to disagree with you.
We were actually on the property. We took magnetic readings from the bars right beside the corral. There was increased magnetic readings. All of that data is in repository at the National Institute for Discovery Science. Now, your question, it depends on the standards of evidence. And, yeah, is it possible to write a scientific paper that is published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal based on what has happened at the property? The answer to that is no. And is it possible to convince a group of skeptical scientists at a symposium based on what has been found at the ranch? The answer is possibly, but, you know, it depends on the level or the standards of evidence. And simply put, the events at the ranch were fleeting. They were extremely fast, and they were never repeated. So the research team spent a lot of time training and in order to operate the equipment extremely quickly. Let me give you one example. We had a portable spectrometer set up with the idea of capturing in real time these lights in order to get a good spectrum. The problem was it required 15 seconds of real-time acquisition of signal. These things lasted for 2 to 3 seconds. So we were never able to get a full spectrum of one of these lights. So when you say hearsay, we do have physical evidence, but it is not sufficient to write a scientific paper.
George Knapp, when we see the documentary in March, the television documentary, might we see some objects, pictures, remnants of the cattle mutilations?
Oh, no question about that. Some of that information had been posted on the NIDS website a couple of years ago, but we have great footage of, well, can't call it great, it's grisly footage.
So you might not have stills, but you've got video to back this
video
up.
Video and stills that Colum and his team acquired of that particular right. incident, as well as several others. I mean,
they just didn't make it into the book, that's all.
That's true.
Okay. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, Tim from Cold Lake, Alberta, Canada.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, just ruined my whole night. I've got about 150 acres beside where I'm living now, so I'm working out there after dark, right? So, you know, hopefully it stays down where you're at in your ranch. It doesn't come up here and bother me at all, right? Hey, I used to be a military policeman in the service. And I listened to your last caller a few back there. He's an SP, security specialist
yes.
at the Air Force.
Yeah.
Your guys' Air Force? Up here, we just have MPs. They work in all branches, Navy, Air Force, Army. We're just all one. But about Area 51, when I was stationed at Goose Bay, as Labrador is in Newfoundland, Labrador, I was there for 3 years. And that whole base is based, built on about 800 feet of sand. I know that because I used to drill for looking for leaks from the big jet fuel tanks. And they went down like over 800 feet before hitting bedrock.
I see.
But United States Air Force pulled out in about 92. I was there when they pulled out. And before they pulled out, and even before that, they got rid of some of their stuff back way back in the bush in the sandy areas. They dug and buried it. And then I found out from the locals that stuff was buried back there way back. The base was built for the Second World War, so you know we're talking the 40s, early 40s, all the way through. And stuff had been buried there over years and years and years. Well, one of my friends had a metal detector, and he was an MP2, and he was doing some searching way back in the area. It's a big area. And that got out, and some intelligence people came up from one branch of the American service, don't know which, because it was really hushed up. And he got interviewed. He let's say he got interrogated. They wanted to know what the hell was going on and what he was looking for. And, you know, we understood it was just equipment buried there, and it wouldn't be any good anymore, like Jeeps and stuff, leftover stuff. But that kind of started a rumor going around that, you know, maybe they buried something else up here in Goose Bay, which is, you know, in Canada, and it was a military base, like Sid USAF at that time. Maybe some of that leftover stuff from 51 or the crap they wanted to get rid of, you know, because it'd be easy to do because, number one, there wasn't even a road in there at that time. You could only go in by ferry, by ship, and it was a two-day cruise. You know, you go up Newfoundland all the way around. But it'd be an absolutely great place to hide stuff.
I wonder what might be there, George.
Well, you know, if you want to get rid of the stuff from Wright-Patterson or Area 51 or whatever.
Well, I guess the secret's out now, isn't it?
It sure is.
Gosh, I'd love to go up on a little treasure hunt, but somebody might beat us to it by now.
That would be... Well, see, I don't think... Why would we bury something as priceless as a craft from a different system?
It doesn't make sense to me unless it's for temporary storage to stash it somewhere. You know, a lot of stories in Area 51 that after all the attention was focused on the base that they just moved it to the interior of the Nevada test site and stashed it for a while until the heat was off. But, you know, that's just stories. I have no idea.
Let's go to one more caller, first-time caller. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Deborah.
Hi, Deborah.
I wanted to ask about, I saw a documentary a couple of months ago about chupacabras. And it discussed the cattle mutilations in New Mexico. There was a New Mexican sheriff there, and I may have been the gentleman someone was talking about earlier. He did an experiment on, they got a dead cow, and he had around-the-clock surveillance. And what they did is found within a day or two that this dead cow that I believe had been euphemized, he had all the same physical characteristics of the cattle mutilations. I'm wondering, I mean, I don't know if that's possible with the ones up there, but
well,
it's an idea.
The ones that were occurring on this Utah ranch occurred, and nobody saw anyone there do it. That's correct, Colm, right?
That happened in March of 1997. Yeah, the animal was essentially half the body weight of the animal was gone over a 45-minute period in broad daylight.
No witnesses.
With two people who were standing 300 yards away who didn't hear anything or see anything. Now, the interesting thing, and really what stunned me about this case, was it is extremely difficult to dismember an animal and not leave a drop of blood on the hide or the inside of the animal. It is extraordinarily difficult. Blood spills. And even an 84-pound calf has a couple of liters of blood. But we even went to the extent of going to the local slaughterhouse, getting a couple of liters of blood and scattering it on the grass to see if over time maybe it would seep into the grass and disappear, and maybe that's where the blood might have gone. Not so. I mean, the hemoglobin from the blood stained the grass.
It's right.
Dead.
It coagulates out there. Colm, we're out of time. George, you too. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, George.
Thank you very much.
All right. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisori, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next program. Until then, be safe, everyone.